My job as a commissioner is to ensure that every beneficiary receives their payments on time.
Concern grows about what DOGE is doing to the Social Security system. Is the worry justified or not? A Social Security expert joins us to cut through all the noise to give us some answers.
Every night and every day, we face the situation where your mind tells you that it is impossible to survive. 40 degrees below zero, avalanches, wind, no food.
If it were not for their Catholic faith, the survivors of a famous plane crash in South America are convinced they would have perished. We talked to one man who made it out alive about how that faith guided his life ever since.
His decision to found Vatican Radio was just prophetic, reaching the ends of the earth with the Pope's voice in all those languages.
Next week marks the 20th anniversary of Pope St. John Paul II's death. Our Vatican Bureau reports on his lasting legacy 20 years later when we speak to his longtime personal secretary. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
Since Elon Musk's Doge took over the Social Security Administration last month, that this administration is intent on dismantling Social Security and cutting millions of Americans' benefits.
The President of the United States has said very clearly that we are not going to cut Social Security benefits.
Senators on Capitol Hill address constituent concerns about changes to the Social Security system millions of Americans depend on for their financial livelihood. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Rasal Regis, in this week for Catherine Hadrow. Those comments came during a tense confirmation hearing on Tuesday for President Donald Trump's nominee to lead the Social Security Administration, who had to answer how he would lead an agency targeted for downsizing by Elon Musk. Mark Irons reports that downsizing is causing Social Security anxiety across the country.
Welcome to the Social Security Administration.
Welcome, but your call is being put on hold for at least 2 hours.
The estimated hold time is greater than 120 minutes.
That automated message from this week when News in Depth called the 1-800 number for Social Security, the 90-year-old federal program that the vast majority of American workers pay into through taxes, provides millions of seniors, those with disabilities, and children who have lost a parent with monthly financial benefits.
Please call back later.
But some callers are growing impatient and instead calling their elected officials in Washington. Those lawmakers say their constituents are frustrated with the Social Security Administration, and it goes beyond waiting on the phone.
Being turned away from walk-in services, difficulty scheduling appointments.
In me, you will have an accountable leader.
This week, in a Senate hearing, President Trump's nominee to head the Social Security Administration, Frank Bisignano, said he's ready to get to work, citing a faithful friend from New York.
My friend, Cardinal Timothy Dolan, once said, "The only just government is government that serves its citizens, not itself." This is the belief I will bring to the Social Security Administration.
But around the country, some seniors are questioning how current Trump administration actions, guided by Elon Musk, the world's richest man, will better serve citizens who rely on Social Security.
How about you way in the back?
I am very, very concerned about what's going on with Musk and Social Security.
At one town hall meeting in Iowa, hosted by Republican Senator Chuck Grassley, an attendee asked how proposed cuts to Social Security staff and field office closures, spearheaded by the work of Musk and Doge or the Department of Government Efficiency, will make Social Security any more efficient.
Try to get an appointment at the local office. Right now, you're waiting a month, and we're going to cut more staff? This is not right.
Democrats on Capitol Hill agree.
It is time to bring a halt to DOGE destruction of Social Security before it goes any further.
Republicans say the Democrats have their own agenda.
The reality is that it is scare tactics.
We're cutting down the size of government. We have to. We're bloated. We're sloppy. We have a lot of people that aren't doing their job.
President Trump says Musk is on a mission to cut out government waste, fraud, and abuse. Meanwhile, there are concerns that a shakeup at the Social Security Administration could impact the on-time delivery of the monthly checks sent out to vulnerable seniors in need. But U.S. Secretary of Commerce and billionaire Howard Lutnick claimed only fraudsters would complain about that.
Let's say Social Security didn't send out their checks this month. My mother-in-law, who's 94, she wouldn't call and complain. She just wouldn't. A fraudster always makes the loudest noise, screaming, yelling, and complaining.
Sharing a much different perspective, we spoke with Cornelius Chambers, a man from Northern Virginia who said his mother, who has Alzheimer's disease, relies on Social Security.
That money from her Social Security helps with whatever she needs as far as medical or anything like that. And if it's taken away, it's going to destroy it and it's going to make it hard. Every person's situation is different. So what may a check may just seem like something to put away for one, may be somebody else's livelihood for them to make it to the next month.
Regardless of cuts to the federal workforce, President Trump has promised there will not be cuts to Social Security monetary benefits given to Americans.
We're not going to touch it. Now, we are going to look for fraud.
Trump has claimed millions and millions of dead people over 100 years old are Social Security beneficiaries, but the president's nominee to run Social Security says improper payments happen at 1%.
President said millions and millions of people. You're saying, and you're right, less than 1%. You want to improve it? You're right. Let's do it. President was lying. And what he was trying to do was undermine the foundations of Social Security by saying the system is out of control.
Social Security has been around since 1935, when President Franklin Roosevelt signed a law creating the federal program. In 1983, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops reiterated a longstanding support of Social Security, going back even before the federal program was created. The statement reads, as early as 1919, Catholic bishops called for the state to provide comprehensive social insurance to provide protection against old age, disability, and illness. In 1999, acknowledging ongoing national concerns about the future of Social Security and questions about how to best preserve it, questions that still remain today, the bishops wrote, changes in Social Security should not put at risk those individuals and families whose resources are already very limited. For some people, like Diane and Gary Janes from Michigan, losing Social Security isn't a big concern.
I'm really not worried about my Social Security getting cut. And if they're making cuts, then they're making them to the workers because they have too many workers. That's okay with me. We need to be more fiscally responsible.
Gary says retirement savings have prepared them for the future.
We've been told Social Security is going away for a long time, right? So if it fails, we've already put enough money aside to stave that off. Not indefinitely. We might have to go back to work, right? Then you go back to work.
But Cornelius says without Social Security, many could suffer.
I know a lot of people who, you know, have houses and their Social Security helps them take care of themselves in their house. Without it, they may lose their homes.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
Perhaps bowing to pressure, a cut to the Social Security customer service phone line, scheduled to begin this Monday, has been postponed for some benefit recipients for 2 weeks. The abrupt shift came after advocacy groups representing seniors and disabled Americans voiced angry opposition to the changes. The acting head of Social Security had earlier announced that all people applying for benefits or changing bank deposit information would no longer be able to do it over the phone and would instead have to confirm their identity online or in person at a field office. But in a confusing about-face this week, a new directive said those applying for Medicare and disability benefits can still conduct their business by phone, but others filing for retirement or survivor benefits must still verify their identities either online or in person. All of this mixed and unclear messaging as DOGE continues to downsize the Social Security workforce. To discuss the current state of play at the Social Security Administration and what that means for the benefits so many Americans rely on, we are joined by Dr. Mark Warshawski. Mark is the former Deputy Commissioner for Retirement and Disability Policy at the Social Security Administration and served on the Social Security Advisory Board for 6 years. He is now a Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he focuses on Social Security, retirement, and pensions. Mark, first of all, what do you think of the situation unfolding right now? The Social Security website crashing, phone calls unanswered, more than half the regional offices overseeing field operations being shuttered. What's your response?
Well, certainly the Social Security Administration has been facing service problems now for several years. The phone system has not worked well. There's a very large backlog of disability claims, people trying to get disability benefits. And I think the moves that DOGE has made, which they claim has been focusing on trying to prevent fraud, really have not addressed the service issues that that people face.
And we are hearing a lot of anxiety from Social Security recipients about current DOGE efforts to reform it. With your knowledge of the Social Security system, is that anxiety warranted? Or do you believe the changes the Department of Government Efficiency is recommending are solid ideas?
I have not been persuaded by the ideas that they've been putting forward. For example, there are claims that there's massive fraud in the retirement program, that people, you know, ages 150 or 200 are getting, you know, billions and billions of dollars of benefits is simply not true. And it's disappointing to hear that they continue to make that claim. It really changes the focus from what it should be, which is to improve service and to, you know, make needed policy changes, particularly in the disability program, where people who deserve benefits should get benefits and people who do not deserve benefits should not. So it's been disappointing that their focus has been really on a problem that doesn't exist.
And going deeper into that, Elon Musk and his DOGE team are focused on cutting waste, fraud, and abuse in government. He recently went on the record to call Social Security a Ponzi scheme. What is your take on that characterization?
Well, Social Security is certainly a promise from one generation to another. People paying in payroll taxes, and they're paying basically benefits to the older generation. So in that sense, it is a promise. It's an understanding between one generation and another. And whether you call it a Ponzi scheme or not is really semantics. But that is the reality. It's not like a pension plan where you have money put aside. That is not the way the system works.
And you kind of mentioned this earlier. Regardless of administrative changes the Trump White House is trying to make now, we have known for years that there are long-term solvency problems with Social Security that Congress has failed to address for decades. These current proposed changes don't really address that, do they? What needs to happen to fix the long-term issues?
Now, these changes, as best as we understand it, are related to the administration of the program. They have nothing to do with the resources of the program or the benefits that are being paid out, which are, not in line currently. We're not getting enough revenue for the benefits that are being paid out. The trust fund is being depleted and will run out of money in about 8 years, at which time benefits will have to be cut. So these changes really do not address that issue at all.
What can fix it? I know there are proposed making it privatized. What do you think will fix it?
Well, there are a lot of ideas out there. This issue has been known for really decades. I would say it's been known for at least 30 years that this problem was looming, and really nothing has changed in those 30 years. Even the timing has not changed much. That is going to happen in early 2030s. So there are a lot of ideas, both on the revenue side and on the benefit side. My personal preference is that people who are well-to-do should get lower benefits. I think that's reasonable. They have very good resources in their pensions and their retirement accounts. And that, I think, is a good way of balancing the system. I think also raising the retirement age, I think, is a good change because people are living longer and working longer. And that also saves money for the system. Those are natural changes that are consistent with the way the economy and the workforce has changed over time.
Right, and we'll see how it unfolds. What final insight about the Social Security system can you share with our viewers who may be concerned about receiving their hard-earned benefits in the future?
Well, I think, on the administrative side, there are problems that do need to be fixed, and hopefully the DOGE people can address it. The programming that Social Security uses, the language it uses is called COBOL, which goes back to the 1960s, is truly out of date. And that's, if they could, fix that problem and that would create real efficiencies and productivity gains. And so I hope they do address that. Also, I think they should address some of these policy issues, particularly on the disability program, to modernize it so to reflect the vocational realities of a modern workforce. So those are doable in a relatively short period of time, 1 or 2 years, and you don't even need Congress to act on anything.
Well, thank you so much for your insight.
My pleasure.
There's much more ahead on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. Pope Francis's doctors say it was really a brush with death. Their comments ahead. And remembering St. Pope John Paul II.
20 years after his death, St. Pope John Paul II's legacy is still felt here in St. Peter's Square. I am Magdalena Volinskariedi. That story coming up next.
And the horror of a plane crash, followed by the despair of months without rescue. A story of Catholic faith, perseverance, and survival. A little later on EWTN News in Depth.
New insight this week into the grave seriousness of Pope Francis's recent illness. To the cheers of the faithful, Pope Francis was released from Gemelli Hospital in Rome last weekend after 5 weeks of treatment for double pneumonia. Thousands of visitors in St. Peter's Square watched on big screen TVs and clapped as they saw the Pope emerge on the hospital balcony.
For me, it was an important emotional experience to see him because many people were waiting for this moment. We pray that he will get better soon, so that he can celebrate this holy year with all his people.
In an interview this week, his lead doctor said the Pope was close to dying 2 times. At the most critical moment, he said the medical team had to decide whether to stop treatment and, quote, let him go. But the pontiff's personal medical assistant, who knows the Pope's wishes, told the team to try everything, don't give up. Through what Dr. Sergio Alfieri described as a terrible evening, the Pope pulled through. Alfieri says he is convinced prayer services around the world contributed to Francis' survival. Doctors have prescribed 2 months of rest and limited activity as he continues oxygen therapy and a prescription drug regimen to help regain his strength. Many of the pilgrims who have come to Rome for this year's Jubilee made the trek over to Gemelli to pray for the Pope outside his hospital room. Below the papal hospital suite stands a now famous statue of Pope St. John Paul II. It depicts him in his later years, stooping and clutching a crucifix, his brow furrowed in pain. Doctors at Gemelli helped save John Paul's life in 1981 after he was shot in St. Peter's Square in a failed assassination attempt. It was the first time a pope had been treated at Rome's largest hospital. John Paul was eventually admitted there nearly 10 times. The statue erected in his honor in 2009 is entitled Be Not Afraid. Next week, April 2nd, marks the 20th anniversary of Pope St. John Paul II's death. One of the most influential popes in history, his legacy lives on 20 years later. From the EWTN Vatican Bureau, reporter Magdalena Walensky-Rady examines that legacy with people who knew him well, including his personal secretary and a Vatican journalist who traveled with him to more than 40 countries.
A także naszych sąsiadów z południa oraz zachodu, bliższych i dalszych.
His incredible charisma moved the world. And the powerful winds of change began sweeping across Eastern Europe from the very start of John Paul II's pontificate. The second longest in the history of the Church.
Gorbachev told the Pope, "I have read your documents, your encyclicals, and have come to the conclusion that something must change in Russia. I heard it with my own ears as he was leaving. Something must change in Russia, all under the influence of John Paul II's teaching."
John Paul II left an indelible mark on the world, a mark that, even 20 years after his death, remains profoundly tangible.
John Paul II changed the world, and the world that we live in today, in the shape it's in, or at least in some aspects, because of John Paul's witness, especially when he went to Poland in 1979 and inspired the people by saying, "Be not afraid," and asking the Holy Spirit to send and to change the face of this land, this Polish land.
Poland was the spark, but the Pope's impact reached far beyond the borders of his homeland, contributing to the fall of communist regimes, once thought unshakable in many other countries. Yet, danger was never far off, and the cost of freedom proved to be incredibly high.
It was right here on this very spot where the shots were fired on the afternoon of May 13, 1981, and the Pope miraculously survived an assassination attempt, firmly believing that the intervention of the Mother of God saved him.
The Pope knew about the devotion to Our Lady of Fatima, but nothing beyond that. Then, while still in the hospital, the thought of the Fatima secret came to his mind. He asked for the text, kept in the congregation for the doctrine of the faith, to be brought to him at Gemelli.
In a recent exclusive interview with EWTN in Krakow, Cardinal Stanisław Dziwisz, the Pope's lifelong personal secretary, revealed details of the Pope's conversations with Sister Lucia of Fatima.
She said, "What Our Lady desired and what was written in those records has been fulfilled." And as a request, she asked the Pope to consecrate Russia to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, together with the bishops in St. Peter's Square.
The Mother of God became like a mother to him after he lost his own as a child. She was the source of strength behind everything he did, especially his prayer. He prayed ceaselessly, filling his days with prayer.
His holiness was most evident in his prayer. He was a man of profound and unwavering prayer. He never displayed it openly, but those close to him could see how long John Paul II prayed.
He always ended his day with a moment of prayer. Whenever he returned to the nunciature, he would go straight to the chapel to pray, always, without exception. While others took time to refresh, eat, make calls, or rest, he placed prayer above everything else.
He prayed for the world and its people, above all, for the youth.
On the last day of his life, crowds of young people gathered here in the heart of St. Peter's Square, united in prayer for him. Their voices reached his windows in the Apostolic Palace, filling him with the joy of knowing that his suffering was not in vain, but had become a legacy for generations to come.
Salve Regina!
20 years ago, the world held its breath for the Pope's death. But despite the passage of time, the presence of St. John Paul II remains strong.
He is at work, and it is visible. People turn to God through him and receive various graces, many of them. I often advise people suffering from cancer who receive the grace of healing through the intercession of John Paul II. And these cases are so evident, so absolutely clear, that there is no doubt. People are convinced that John Paul II has acted.
In Rome, Magdalena Wolinska-Riedi, EWTN News in Depth.
Next week, there will be several events at the Vatican to mark the 20th anniversary of Pope St. John Paul II's death, a concert on April 1st, a mass at St. Peter's Basilica, and a special prayer service in St. Peter's Square at 9 p.m. on April 2nd, which will end at 9:37 p.m., the moment of John Paul's death. In Rome, a memorial mass for our foundress, Mother Angelica, who passed away 9 years ago at the age of 92. A fiery Poor Clare nun, she launched the Eternal Word television network in 1981, inspiring people around the world with her timeless wisdom on live TV. Even after a debilitating stroke left her unable to speak in 2001, her private life continued to point to God's providence. She returned to the Lord on Easter Sunday, 2016. We remember Mother for her wit, her joy, and most importantly, her love for Christ, her spouse. We thank God for her legacy. News headlines are next in the Week in Review.
Nobody was texting war plans, and that's all I have to say about that. Right, thank you.
Nobody's texting war plans.
I
know exactly what I'm doing, exactly what we're directing.
Nobody's texting war plans. There's no units, no locations, no routes, no flight paths, no sources, no methods, no classified information.
Questions and concerns continue over a leaked text chat among senior national security officials that critics say, if hacked, could have threatened the lives of U.S. military personnel. That news tops the Week in Review. The text thread on the Signal messaging app was revealed by a journalist for The Atlantic magazine who was accidentally invited into the chat that included the Secretary of Defense, the Vice President, the National Security Advisor, the Director of National Intelligence, and the CIA Director. During the chat over unsecured personal phones, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth posted multiple details about impending U.S. military airstrikes against Yemen's Houthi rebels before the American pilots were airborne. Members of the Intelligence Committee were grilled this week in a hearing on Capitol Hill.
Would not information about the timing of airstrikes allow a military to pre-position or cue air defense systems to shoot down enemy aircraft?
I think, Senator, from our perspective, any advance warning is something that we certainly are trying to protect. Yeah.
Director Radcliffe, this was a huge mistake, correct?
No.
The testimony happened in a contentious hearing on Capitol Hill that had already been scheduled with the nation's top intelligence officials before the Signal chat was leaked. Those officials testified they did not share classified information.
You think
these terrorists
will benefit
Republican justice? Republican lawmakers who have said today that your administration should take more accountability and not downplay what's happened with Signal that we've seen in these messages today.
Well, I don't know about downplaying. The press upplays it. I think it's all a witch hunt. That's all. I think it's a witch hunt. I wasn't involved with it. I wasn't there.
Do you still believe nothing classified was shared?
Well, that's what I've heard. I don't know. I'm not sure. You'll have to ask the various people involved. I really don't know.
For analysis of the Signal leak, we now turn to Amy Mitchell, an expert on defense and national security. She's a senior fellow at the National Security Institute at George Mason University and has advised three secretaries of defense. Amy, in your prior work advising secretaries of defense, what would you have told your boss about whether or not he should send war plans over a non-secured platform like Signal?
Thanks, Roselle. I would have advised the secretary, one, not to use Signal. The Department of Defense has numerous communications capabilities that are accessible to the secretary, especially, and to communicate strictly via those channels for the exact reason that we've seen this week.
Yeah, and government officials both in the administration and on Capitol Hill who have defended those on that Signal group chat have said it was a glitch, a mistake, but that the conversation was not classified. What is your reaction to that?
So there's been a lot of semantics being bounced around. first off, a war plan is just that. It's just a plan. But when you add in timing and make it an operational plan, that is absolutely classified. The appetite for any type of investigation within the administration is clearly off the table. So it will really fall to Congress to see how they want to handle it. And they are looking at this very seriously.
The signal chat was apparently conducted on personal phones instead of government-issued secure devices. Not only that, but one of the participants, U.S. Envoy Steve Witkoff, was actually in the Kremlin at the time, conducting negotiations about Ukraine with Vladimir Putin. What kind of risk does that present?
It's a really high risk, Roselle. So, you know, before the election and during the election, we saw that a lot of who became senior Trump administration officials, their phones had been breached and personal information had been shared by our adversaries and bad actors. And it really seems like they did not learn a lesson from that to ensure that there is cybersecurity across the board for senior leadership. And using a personal phone when you've been given a government phone, unless you are actively CCing your government account so that there is a record and people understand that you are trying to keep the information contained, again, huge breach of protocol.
Wow. And from a national security perspective, what do you think our allies, with whom we have traditionally shared intelligence, make of the security breach?
I think they're looking at it, well, two issues there. I think that in the discussion between all the participants on the signal chat, you saw kind of unvarnished disdain for Europe and many of our allies. And that is really one of the longer term effects of the disclosure of this information. I think that Europe was thinking prior to this, let's wait a couple years, things will come back, you know, calm back down in the next administration. I think that they are seeing that the United States is very serious about what it's been saying to them, both publicly and privately. Secondly, in terms of intelligence sharing, obviously they are going to want to have our assurance that whatever is being shared does not go public in the future. And I think we'll see a pullback on some of that, and it will most directly affect what we call our Five Eyes partnership, which is the UK, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand, where we have massive intelligence sharing across that network. And I think that they are now asking themselves, how do we deal with this in the future?
In your opinion, what should the consequences be for those who participated in the Signal group chat? Can this be chalked up as a learning experience, or should the repercussions be more serious than that?
Thanks, Roselle. Under normal circumstances, this would be treated very seriously. And so I think across the board, we're seeing a lack of credibility moving forward. And that credibility issue and trust issue is going to extend from the Secretary of Defense to the Secretary of State to the National Security Advisor. And now that DOJ has chimed in with Attorney General Pat Bondi saying that we won't prosecute this case, it's going to put a big trust issue going forward, both with the public and with the federal workforce. And we've already seen, you know, another case of this over at DHS where information was inadvertently shared. The employee immediately alerted her supervisors. She was immediately put on leave. Her security clearance was revoked. And since, she has been fired from the position. So we're seeing a difference in how we're treating people, and that will have a chilling effect across the government.
Well, Amy Mitchell, thank you so much for your time and your insight.
Thank you so much, Roselle.
And now an update to our top story last week. An appeals court has upheld a block on the Trump administration's deportation of hundreds of Venezuelan migrants under the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. In a divided ruling on Wednesday, the D.C. District Court of Appeals said the White House's swift deportation of Venezuelan migrants, whom it says belonged to the Tren de Aragua gang, was unconstitutional. The Trump administration used the centuries-old Wartime Act to quickly deport the alleged gang members with no chance to challenge their removal. Despite pressure from the president himself, District Judge James Boasberg quickly blocked the administration from deporting any more of the migrants as the lawsuit progressed. The appeals court agreed to freeze the status quo and keep the block in place.
I agree that the district court looks like it may be acting on a preliminary injunction soon, but I think the intrusion upon the war powers and foreign policy powers of the president is utterly unprecedented. And in a way...
Well, this is an unprecedented action as well. So, of course, there's no precedent for it because no president has ever used this statute this way.
Trump might ask the Supreme Court to intervene in the case. Judge Boasberg is also determining whether the White House violated the block when it refused to return the deportation flights back to the U.S. After intense negotiations with the U.S., Russia and Ukraine have agreed on a limited ceasefire in the Black Sea. It's part of the first truce between the two countries since the war began, but the details remain murky. The United States announced a truce on Tuesday after 3 days of talks in Saudi Arabia. The ceasefire would eliminate the use of force in the Black Sea, but both sides disagree on how and when it will start. Russia seeks to benefit by getting some of its sanctions lifted and fewer attacks on its sea fleet. But Ukraine, which has already secured navigation in the sea, gains little from the agreement unless its ports are protected from Russian fire. The two sides also agreed to halt firing on energy infrastructure, though Ukraine and Russia accuse the other of violating its terms. Large protest in Gaza as the war's death toll reached 50,000 Palestinians. That grim milestone announced by Gaza's health ministry on Sunday as Israel continues its renewed offensive in the territory. Thousands of Palestinians marched through rubble on Thursday, calling for an end to the war and chanting against Hamas. It was a rare act of protest against the militant group, which has violently cracked down on previous demonstrations. Israel reignited its operations in Gaza after a six-week ceasefire came to an end and promises its pressure on Hamas will continue to grow until all Israeli hostages are freed. The United Nations has announced it is pulling aid workers from Gaza after an Israeli strike hit one of its compounds last week. On Monday, the organization said it would reduce its footprint in the Strip by a third, the first time it is doing so since the start of the war in 2023. Israel has blocked all humanitarian aid into Gaza for 3 weeks. 17 months of war have left most of the enclave in rubble, and more than a million Palestinians are left without food, shelter, and medicine. This week, President Trump announced a steep 25% tariff on all imported cars and auto parts. It's the latest of many tariffs the president has imposed on our biggest trade partners. The tariff is set to go into effect on April 3rd. The administration hopes to boost U.S. auto manufacturing by encouraging buyers to purchase American-made automobiles. But car makers emphasize that even cars built in U.S. factories could face steeper prices because they rely on imported parts from countries like Canada and Mexico. Foreign leaders quickly criticized the tariffs, and Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney said his country might respond with more retaliatory tariffs. A powerful earthquake rocked Myanmar and neighboring Thailand, killing more than 150 people and leaving hundreds injured. Footage from Myanmar showed widespread destruction. The 7.7 magnitude quake struck at midday and was followed by a strong 6.4 magnitude aftershock. The full extent of death, injury, and destruction was not immediately clear, particularly in Myanmar, one of the world's poorest countries embroiled in a civil war. In Thailand, at least three people were killed in the capital, Bangkok, and dozens buried when a building under construction collapsed.
Well, we were waiting to be rescued by the outside world. The day we heard on the radio they were no longer looking for us, we realized that the only way we could survive was by our own means.
Next,
pure desperation as survivors of a plane crash realize no one would be coming to find them at their remote crash site. That story right after this.
We were surrounded by death. Being alive was an act of defiance. If they had told us on the first day that we were going to stay there for 3 months, we would have died.
A horrific tale of survival in the Andes Mountains. After a plane crash that took the lives of many, those who survived battled unimaginable challenges as they awaited their rescue. More than 50 years after the plane crash and the incredible survival story that went with it, we revisited the tragedy with one of the victims. He says if it were not for their Catholic faith, those who survived the crash would not have lasted the months it took until their eventual rescue. And now, as he reflects on the incident decades later, he is more convinced than ever that God was their savior. Gustavo Zerbino is on the record with reporter Paula Flynn.
On Friday, October 13, 1972, a nightmare became reality when a Uruguayan plane carrying 45 young rugby players crashed in the Andes Mountains. For those who survived the initial impact, the next 72 days became a relentless battle against hunger and freezing temperatures as low as minus 22 degrees Fahrenheit.
Cuando caímos,
when we crashed, 16 people died instantly, leaving 29 survivors. In the following nights and days, more lives were lost. Then on October 29th, an avalanche buried 8 more. The remaining 3 succumbed to infected wounds.
Among the 16 survivors was 19-year-old Gustavo Zerbino, who had just started his first 3 months of medical school. He became the group's doctor, caring for his friends until their final moments. As the days passed, the group became more and more hungry, and with no food, they had to do the unthinkable. They decided to consume the bodies of those who had died. Gustavo took it upon himself to collect the belongings of the deceased, determined to return them to their families in Uruguay. He promised each one that he would deliver them to their loved ones, just as he did for his friend Gustavo Nicolich.
There is a letter from Gustavo Nicolich in which he writes to his mother and his girlfriend, "From the depths of my being, we prayed to God that this day would not come, but it has arrived, and we must accept it with courage and faith. Faith, because if the bodies are here, it is because God has placed them here. And today we begin to feed ourselves from them. And if the day comes when I can sustain my friends with my body, I would do so with great joy."
For Gustavo, despite the horror of the situation, he says Our Lady was always there with them in those snowy mountains. At night, when temperatures dropped and the young men sheltered inside the plane wreckage, huddling together to keep warm, the only sound breaking the silence was them praying the rosary.
De noche, durante 73 días.
At night, for 73 nights, we prayed the rosary every night for 3 reasons. First, to thank God that we were alive and to ask the Virgin for strength. Suddenly, during the day, we thanked her. 8 had died in the avalanche, but we still gave thanks because being alive was already a reason to be grateful. There were 16 of us, and we formed a circle. Every 5 minutes, someone had to pray the rosary out loud because if you fell asleep, you would freeze to death.
On October the 21st, the search efforts were called off, but even in the depths of despair, the rugby team never lost hope.
Gustavo, did you have any conversations with God during these days?
All day long, but we had direct communication. God was the friend who gave you water, who massaged your feet, who embraced you, the love. In that place on the mountain, you are so small, and the mountain is so big that you can feel the presence of God.
60 days after the crash, Fernando Parrado and Roberto Canessa made the decision to leave the group and search for help, even though the chances were so high they would die along the way. After 10 days of stumbling through the snow, they finally encountered a man who came to their aid. And on December the 22nd, 72 days after the crash, the Chilean Air Force sent 3 helicopters to the valley where the survivors were located. And the news of their rescue spread across the world.
How have these years been since then?
Wonderful. Every day when I wake up, I have 1,440 minutes to do whatever I want. I am so grateful. Everything I do in this world is a reminder of my friends who physically died but live inside me, and every person in front of me is a brother. That is why life is an excitement and a great gift.
In Madrid, Paola Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
Reporter Paola Flynn joins me now to discuss the story. Paola, this was an extraordinary conversation. It's unbelievable what he lived through. I'm wondering, of all the things Gustavo Zerbino discussed with you, what stands out for you personally?
Rochelle, it was such a beautiful and impactful story. I especially remember the way Gustavo speaks about Arturo Nogueira, one of his friends, who had broken his legs after the plane crashed and he couldn't move, so they put him in a hammock. And one day, Arturo threw this little bottle at Gustavo to get his attention. Gustavo put him down and he realized that Arturo couldn't breathe, that his lungs were collapsed. So he performed this maneuver where he was pushing his diaphragm to help him breathe. But he said, "Do you realize that every time I stop doing this, you start choking, you start dying?" And Arturo kept holding on to him, not to let him die. He was afraid. And after 2 hours of performing this maneuver constantly, he said to Arturo, "You've been a good guy, and death is the culmination of life, so don't be afraid." And at that moment, Arturo let go, and he died peacefully. So to me, a 21-year-old, Arturo was 21 years old, coming to terms with his own death, is so impactful.
Right. What an incredible story. Thank you so much, Paola.
Thank you, Rochelle.
Next, 24 Hours for the Lord and the Power of Confession, a sacramental weekend at the Vatican as the missionaries of mercy gather for their jubilee. The faith-filled celebration when we return. A marathon of mercy in Rome. This weekend, dioceses around the world will host 24 Hours for the Lord, an annual initiative of prayer and Eucharistic adoration introduced by Pope Francis more than a decade ago. For 24 hours straight, churches leave their door open for faithful to encounter the Eucharist. At the center of the prayer marathon is the sacrament of confession. And in Rome, a special 24 hours during the Jubilee, led by the Holy Father's own Missionaries of Mercy. Millions of pilgrims have already journeyed to Rome this year from all four corners of the world for the Jubilee of Hope. Throughout the year, the Vatican is holding numerous celebrations to highlight special groups of faithful. Some of the jubilees hosted by the Vatican so far have been for the armed forces, permanent deacons, and communicators. This weekend, another special jubilee will take place, this one for the Missionaries of Mercy. Pope Francis commissioned this group of priests in 2016 during the extraordinary Jubilee of Mercy and has asked them in a special way to preach God's mercy and administer the sacrament of confession. More than 500 of these missionaries are gathered in Rome this weekend. Here to share more about this special ministry is one of those missionaries of mercy. Father John Maria Devaney is a Dominican friar and pastor of St. Pius V Catholic Church in Providence, Rhode Island. He is attending the Jubilee and joins us from our EWTN News Vatican Bureau. Father, how did you become a missionary of mercy?
So the Missionaries of Mercy go back almost a decade, and there was an invitation from the Holy Father where the Jubilee Year of Mercy was proclaimed, and he needed priests to do some special work. So our bishops throughout the world and religious superiors invited priests, both who are, you know, friars or monks or religious order priests and diocesan priests, to join in a special way the Jubilee Year in 2015 and 2016. We didn't know when we signed up that we would end up being commissioned on Ash Wednesday 2016 from St. Peter's by Pope Francis to go into the world and just really proclaim God's mercy, also help really renew people back to the sacrament of confession. And then also, as the Jubilee year closed, we were kept on. And here we are almost a decade later now, and we've returned many times for further instruction and gathering and fraternity to keep this kind of mission of mercy alive for our Holy Father.
And before we get into why you're there in Rome, you were a hospital chaplain during COVID-19 in New York. What are your reflections about administering God's ministry, or mercy, rather, to those who needed it most during such an isolating period?
Sure, it was quite intense, as you could imagine, being in New York. The Dominican friars have served for almost a century at major hospitals on New York's Upper East Side. And as the pandemic was unfolding, you know, we knew this was going to be big. We were actually a few days ahead of the media and the government, knowing on the front line that this was going to be huge. We were very fortunate as Catholic priests that we never lost access to the patients. Now, we had to, of course, obey the medical staff when we could go in rooms, when we couldn't, with the proper medical equipment. But really, with the priesthood, you're, as we say, in persona Christi, in the person of Christ. So it was kind of like Jesus was saying, I want to walk those floors, and guess what? You're coming with me. So that was quite a beautiful moment in one's priesthood, but also to be a comforting, obviously with last rites and be merciful for people who are getting ready to go to God into eternal life. But also a large majority of our work was just to accompany the medical staff who are in the trenches, almost the way an army chaplain would accompany soldiers at war.
Right. Thank you so much for all the work you've done. And more than 500 missionaries of mercy have gathered this weekend for the Jubilee. What is it like to be at the Vatican with so many of your brother priests?
Well, it's quite edifying. It's also encouraging. And it's really fascinating to see, like, the global face of the priesthood. Priests from every country in the world, or many countries in the world, all different age groups, all different ethnicities, and to see how we can all come to Rome. You know, when you come to Rome, everybody, if you're Catholic, you're home in Rome. You know, Jesus established the church with Peter and Paul in Rome, and to come together as his priests, to listen to the Holy Father, even though, you know, despite his recovery right now, it looks like we're not going to be have our audience with him this time, but we've been told that he's going to deliver us a message. So we'll hear words of encouragement from the Holy Father as he's witnessing to the mercy of God and hope in his convalescence.
Wonderful. And the meeting's theme is forgiveness as a source of hope. What are your reflections on that? How does mercy bring hope?
Well, if you think about this, right, all of us sin. When I used to work in the hospitals, I'd say, someone would say, oh, Father, I really don't have any sins. I was like, well, there were only two perfect people who ever walked this earth, Jesus and his mother. I'd say, start talking, you know. So, you know, when you give someone the encounter of mercy through, obviously, with Catholics, the great sacrament of confession instituted by Jesus on Easter Sunday night in the upper room, and they have this ability to leave their past behind and not have their future dictated by their past, it gives them a renewal of hope, right? If we believe hope is put into us at our baptism, that's sealed by the Holy Spirit, you know, on our very soul, then hope can always get renewed. And the greatest hope is that indeed there is mercy throughout life and then the great gift of eternal life. So when people encounter forgiveness, they really can be renewed in the hope to keep going through not just a difficult day, a difficult illness, maybe a sinful past, but also to look forward to heaven.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for your time, Father, and we will pray for you.
And we'll pray for you from Rome with the Jubilee and the Missionaries of Mercy. Thank you very much, Rochelle.
Thank you. EWTN will bring you the biggest moments from the Jubilee of Hope in Rome, including the long-awaited canonization of the first millennial saint, Blessed Carlo Acutis. You can watch that Mass here on Sunday, April 27 at 4:30 a.m. Eastern, with a repeat at 7 p.m. To learn more about our programming or to plan your own trip to Rome, you can download the EWTN Jubilee app on your phone. And that's a wrap on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Rochelle Regis. Next week at this time, join us for an EWTN News In-Depth special report. My colleague Colin Flynn retraces the Holy Father's historic trip to Southeast Asia last year, the longest in Pope Francis' pontificate. We hope to see you then for this beautiful overview of that historic apostolic journey. Until then, God bless.